When events come as quickly and ferociously as they seem to lately, it can be hard to get a handle on the overall span of American history. And if you wanted to, how would you go about it? There's a fair amount of criticism leveled at the traditional way of teaching history, the event and date listing above all. That is not the approach taken in the history series at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. It's called American Revolutions, the United States History Cycle, and it commissions notable playwrights to create plays about key moments in American history. More than 30 plays are envisioned. We'll spend the hour talking about the project and other developments at OSF with Nataki Garrett, OSF's recently installed artistic director. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you here for the first time. Allison Carey is back with us as well, the director of the American Revolutions Project. Allison, always good to see you.
It was great to see you, Jeffrey. Thank you.
So, Allison, let's start with you. Give us the origin story about how American Revolutions got started and with what set of goals.
Sure. So it was actually when former artistic director Bill Rausch first dreamed of being at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. He turned to Shakespeare for inspiration and said, what did Shakespeare do that we haven't done yet? And that was write the history of his people onto the stage and really helped shape British identity for centuries following that. And so Bill thought, we should do that. And he, of course, being Bill, had pictured a big program. Shakespeare wrote 10 history plays. Bill was determined to have more than that. So we eventually looked at a lot of different potential lenses, decided we would go for 37 plays, because that is the number of plays in the Shakespeare canon at OSF. People always ask me, why 37 new plays? And we thought a lot about different ways, as I mentioned, of different lenses we could look at, one for every state, one for every decade, one for every presidential term. But what we realized is the most important thing, above all else, which will surprise no one, is that we get really good plays. And we decided the best way to get really good plays was to give playwrights the option to write about what they believed in and cared about most. And so the thing we ask is that writers write about moments of change, which pretty much all plays are about, because something's got to happen on stage to make it a good play. But beyond that, you know, we don't claim that this is a definitive history of the United States, which, if anybody ever does that, know that they're lying, because no such thing is possible. But so we're going to get an impressionistic patchwork of what writers care about in the moments that they write their plays, and perhaps what the larger American zeitgeist is most itching with as we move through this period when the playwrights are writing and developing their plays.
When I think about the focus on moments of change in American history, I have to wonder if you think about commissioning 37 more just in the last 3 or 4 years.
Or just in the last 3 or 4 days. You know, I mean, yeah, one of the things that we first talked about, when we developed the program, we talked to playwrights and producers and a lot of OSF patrons and people around the country. And it was interesting because the thing that kept popping, which has led to our choosing to look at moments of change, is that people were very aware of the pace of change accelerating it over the course of their lives. And maybe that's an impression that I, as an older person, you know, it might be that's just the way I perceive time, but it did seem pretty universal. And so, yes, history has borne out that concern in terms of accelerating change and accelerating events.
For you, Nataki Garrett, this is a project that was well underway when you arrived. I mean, so is it pretty much a hands-off thing? I mean, have you given much input for steering it from where it goes from here?
Oh, certainly. I'm a part of the team that chose the last six, and we'll choose the seventh writer to be commissioned in American Revolution. So I'm actually really pleased to have been a part of the end of this conversation about American history. That's sort of a beginning of a conversation about American history.
So even before you came here, you must have heard a fair amount about the project.
Oh, certainly, yes.
American Revolution. I mean, aware of the plays making it to Broadway, for example.
Mm-hmm, certainly. Of course, I saw Sweat on Broadway. It was one of my favorite plays that year. I was really excited about Indecent. I also saw that on Broadway. I feel like the impact of those plays, just like Allison said, the impact of those plays is that it opens up the status quo to a deeper understanding of what history has done, what the impact of history is. When you hear from playwrights who are usually not heard from, when you hear from playwrights who come from different cultural backgrounds, different identity, different genders, what you have is the impact of that work on a group of people who felt really satisfied with how history was taught and And then you have another group of people who come into those rooms and they experience finally being seen and heard and felt and understood. And that is impactful to be seen in the work on the stage.
Yeah.
Is that a conscious sort of thrust toward producing oh yeah moments for people sitting there going, oh yeah, I never thought of it quite that way?
I think one of the yes and, one of the things we talk about often, and we pull the playwrights together once a year, is that people, especially the way I think history is sometimes taught, and maybe it's the nature of a classroom experience, and I'm sure the classroom experience has changed since I was there, is that history is inevitable. And so if history is inevitable, nobody ever did anything wrong. Right? It was just what happened. And that leaves out and erases the experience of people who were wronged. It erases the power of people who did the wrong, erases them in terms of history and responsibility. And so I think a lot of it is about aha moments, but it is also about actually reconstructing or trying to suggest to people that inevitability is not part of the human experience. And if we can do that, then we get towards controlling our future more aggressively and saying, oh, there are forces that we can counteract, but we have to acknowledge them first.
And I think what's really exciting about that is that we have a shared history. And often history is codified, your history, your history, your history. But we, especially those of us who live in the American experiment, we have a shared history. And what these plays acknowledge is the intersections in our stories and the intersections of impact in our stories.
And I also think, you know, one of the great things is when choosing the playwrights, we look for a lot of different varieties, but we also look for variety of storytelling and variety of focus in the way people, what stories people focus on. So you can have a very small personal story that really is reflective of this larger historical forces going on, and then you can have the very large writ stories so that you understand that history is not just moving through time, it's moving through scale in all kinds of different ways.
Well, there was something you were saying, Nataki, about the different ways in which we tend to view history, and ultimately I think it comes down to that horrible old saw that I have to bring in here, which is the winners write the history books, that whole view of things. And the fact is that the people who lose in that sense are not losing a game. They're often losing their lives, their freedom, any one of a number of different things. And so it really is, I see the point here. What you're trying to get onto stage is some representation of all of the things that happen to people in a particular point in history.
Also, the victors lose something as well. They lose their humanity. They lose their empathy. They lose their understanding of the impact that they have on the world. And then they keep moving in that direction as if there is no impact. There's no consequence to the work that they do. And then here we are in 2019, where there's a lot of conversation right now about impact and consequence, and people are feeling very sensitive when you have to acknowledge what it took for you to get to where you are and perhaps what it took for me to get to where I am. Those conversations are very difficult. So I actually don't think that anyone has really benefited from the codified versions of history that we've been taught. And I'm really thankful to witness history being spoken about in a much broader way, because I think it has a deeper impact on the spirit of our humanity, you know, of not just this country, countries, you know, across the world.
So, Allison, you were saying that you don't do anything in terms of say to the playwright, do this. You know, we want to play about this. It's what they choose to bring here. I mean, there must be some coordination that to make sure you don't have two people working on the same sort of chunk of history.
We bring the playwrights together once a year, and I do. Then they affect each other, and they say, well, "What are you writing about?" And oh, that makes me think this. But it's interesting to go back a little bit in history to 2012. We had two plays on two stages at the same time. One was All the Way, which is about LBJ's first year in office, and one was about Party People, which was about the Black Panthers and the Young Lords. And they weren't exactly on the same years, but they were certainly on the same time of examination revolution. And so you might say, well, they're kind of looking at the same thing, and they're not looking at the same thing at all, which is another way of reinforcing the complication of history and really bringing forward how much choice there is in how we tell our history. So we have not had two people sit down and say, I desperately want to write a play about Millard Fillmore in this year of his presidency. But on the other hand, if two people wanted to, wouldn't that be awesome?
It would be amazing. Those two points of view would be really, really quite awesome to witness.
Well, there are things he's famous for. Didn't he have the first flushing toilet in the White House?
Now, see, Fillmore? These are the things. I think I know something about history, and yet you expand my mind every time we talk, and I will.
Happy to be providing that service for you here. Nataki Garrett, it seems like the choices of playwrights are potentially based on things you hope these playwrights bring in terms of subject material.
I think in some ways, I think it's also like these are the voices that are doing really interesting things. They're writing really important plays right now. They're impacting communities right now. And so I think it's also about, I trust the playwrights. I trust Shakespeare. I trust the Greeks. You know, I trust storytellers. I trust African myth tellers. I trust the storytellers of the world because they have their ear lowest to the ground. They're actually listening to the heartbeat of our conscious. And so most of the playwrights that I'm interested in are people who are writing about things in ways that I can't imagine myself. And I just want to see what it's like to play in their worlds.
So some of the plays of the American Revolutions Project have been co-commissions with other theater companies. And so is it the same sort of, here's the playwright, go do the work? Or is there any other direction that comes from having a joint project with another theater?
The joint projects begin with, and this was one of the core principles we started the program with, asking the playwright if they want the play to have another artistic home. And we did that for a couple of reasons. One is because some playwrights have very deep relationships with theaters, and we want them to have those relationships in the development of these plays if they want them. There's the secondary reason that we know that even though we are commissioning the plays over 10 years, and they will take some time to all get written, there are chances, and it has happened, that we are considering an enormous number of plays for, say, the following season. We're looking at We're Choosing Now plays for 2021. And we don't ever want to have a playwright write a play for a moment in time and we say, well, we can't produce it right now, so we're going to stick it in our drawer for a couple of years. And because that's the way you kill plays. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in that. So if because of simple logistical reality that we can't only produce plays from American Revolutions, although that wouldn't be terrible. That's my perspective. I know. But you know, we want these plays to have a robust place in the broader American theatrical culture, not just OSF. And that was one way to do it. But we don't force playwrights to do that because sometimes they think, well, it's easier if I just work with one theater, and we're fine with that too.
So let's talk about, we were talking, by the way, about the American Revolution's United States history cycle of plays at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival here with Allison Carey, who runs the project, and Nataki Garrett, who runs the whole kit and caboodle. She's the artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And so let's talk about the playwrights that you recently announced. So it's Zakiya Alexander, mm-hmm. Jacqueline Backhouse, E.M. Lewis, who we had in here recently, Mary Catherine Nagel, Sarah Novich, and Sanaz Tuzi. Well, let's start with E.M. Lewis, because she was here not long ago talking about her play, The Gun Show. So yep. Has she identified a project, or at this point, is it just you've picked the people and they're working on picking what they're going to do?
She has another core principle we started with American Revolutions with is we were going to do at least one play that looked at Oregon history. E.M. Lewis, as you know, is born and bred in Oregon, still lives in the Willamette Valley. So when we thought, who is the person that we are going to trust with this story, and who is the person who might trust us to tell this story well, we instantly thought of Ellen Lewis. And she is going to be, she has already started traveling Oregon and talking to people, doing interviews. And I don't want to get out ahead of what she's writing about, but I do think there are questions of the urban-rural divide, questions of how we hold the history of Oregon that will move through her work. And so she has already begun thinking and planning and envisioning the world she'll create.
Let's move through the rest of the list because these are
impressive. I just want to say that this is also a co-commission with Artists Rep in Portland, which is a great example of a healthy collaboration with another theater because E.M. Lewis has had a long-standing relationship with them, and they're great, and we're so excited to, you know, collaborate with a sister Oregon theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool within the state. Let's talk about the other playwright. Zakiya Alexander has, this is a very, very long list of credits. Oh, even looking at her television credits, Grey's Anatomy 24 and an upcoming show on Amazon called The Hunt. But then The Good Muslim, You Are Here, Girl Shakes Loose, 10 Things to Do Before I Die. It's a long list.
Yeah.
She's a
fine playwright, fine writer, and she's also an actor, which is interesting to look at this list of playwrights and other playwrights. Oftentimes, there are so many people now in the field who can do more than one thing, but also being an actor gives you a very specific lens on translating, putting on the page words that come out of the human mouth with the kind of stylistic oomph that we want in our plays. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the... We look at artists in their wholeness, not just in their specific playwright unfolding of their personality. And I would say that another thing about Zakiya is she is co-founder of the Kilroy's List, which is really bringing forth women writers, and it's a terrific, terrific thing.
And that's where I know Zakiya from, as a co-founder of the Kilroy's. It's a it's a group that focuses on gender parity in playwriting. What they do is they poll dramaturgs and literary managers and directors of literary in theater and artistic directors for the last best plays that they read and did not produce by women, and then they create that list.
So
and that comes out every single year since 2015.
Mm-hmm. Which provides an incredible resource for people who want to produce great plays by women.
So yeah. Did that? It must have helped then with hiring the people for this stage of the American Revolutions project?
Well, actually, I think that OSF is ahead of the curve in this conversation about parity and social justice and creating opportunities for people who are not necessarily seen or heard. I think that the Kilroy's is an answer to that in some way or another, mostly because artistic directors across the United States were telling women, oh, well, I would like to produce more women. I just don't have any. I don't know of any. I haven't read any.
So this is the answer to that question.
Exactly.
Really?
Yes, exactly. I'm sure you've read one that you really loved.
So the thing I couldn't believe about Zakiya Alexander's list, though, is that she seems so busy. How could she find time to work on a play for American Revolutions?
Yeah, that's so the artistic, you know, the artistic space is like you can do anything. You can do just about anything. You wake up in the morning and you write a play, and then you go and you stand on a stage, and then you're in a rehearsal and you do all of those things. Most of the playwrights I know are like working like Zakiya. They're doing television, they're writing a number of plays, they're getting them produced, they're acting, they're doing all of it.
Wow. It's interesting because I would say a couple of years ago there was a sort of general groan in the theater field because so many playwrights were writing for television, which meant that they weren't available for us. And then, of course, the American theater, I think, woke up to the fact that television gives playwrights health insurance, a regular salary. The way television has changed and expanded the voices that it puts on the screen. And, you know, where a television writer might have been 10 years ago locked into a 22-24 episode season, you have shorter seasons now. So playwrights actually have time to do plays and do television. So in some ways, after shaking our fists at television, we are now, thank you, television, for giving playwrights the stability and freedom that we could not as theater. Because there's this old, speaking of, you know, old sayings, previously playwrights would talk about the fact that in theater you could make a killing, but you couldn't make a living.
Yes, that's true. That's part of why I'm looking for an intersection between most of my playwright friends, and I have a number of playwright friends, because I develop new work as a part of, you know, the sort of basis of my work. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking for a way to intersect people who work on the stage and their work on the screen. I want to find a place to develop all of that work together, utilizing the artists, the amazing artistry of the people of OSF.
Nataki Garrett is the artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Allison Carey is the director of the American Revolutions United States History Cycle, which is, we're talking about that, but a whole lot more. Obviously, the world around us that creates something like the American Revolutions project. Jacqueline Backhouse is another person on the list here, if we're going alphabetically. Another New Yorker, also busy, Lincoln Center playwright in residence. So you've got some tip-top talent here to bring in plays for this next round of American Revolutions material.
Yeah, we do. Jacqueline, I think, came to us because India Pale Ale is a play that basically everyone at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival fell deeply in love with. And she's a younger playwright. And the notion of having her brain and her skill working with our company to create a play is just one of those things you wake up in the morning and you're like, good day at work. I get to do this.
We talked about E.M. Lewis. Let's go on to Mary Catherine Nagel, who apparently brings a lot of life experience and a law degree to her playwriting. Is that right?
She has a law degree. She is a practicing attorney who regularly writes briefs that are sent off to the Supreme Court. And so you talk about, you know, the breadth
talk
of
about
experience.
A tough audience, huh?
And I, you know, I know Mary Catherine pretty well. And I there's some people in the world where you wonder, I literally cannot imagine how you do what you do, because she is a fully practicing attorney and she writes these great plays. She was the author of Manhattan, seen on our stages last year.
One of my most favorite plays ever.
Yes, mm-hmm. Totally. And she runs the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. So she is, we are very lucky to have her. And she is going to be great. And I hope you get some sleep, Mary Catherine, if you're listening right now.
Sarah Novich next on the list. She's a novelist. Has she written a play before?
She's not written a play before. She has spoken often about wanting to write plays. She's been involved in various forums at the Theater Communications Group, which is the service organization for the American theater. She is a deaf playwright and deaf writer, and deaf writers do not get a lot of support in the theater field. Her book, Girl at War, which I read, which is about the effect of the Yugoslavian conflicts on a young girl, is an extraordinary piece of work. And so the opportunity to bring that strong voice, which we already know through her novel work, and it's also interesting because you read her novel and it's very dialogue filled. So it's like her playwright is like, hi, I'm right here. I'm in this great novel
her
that I
wrote. Her inner playwright is looking to come out, yes.
So we thought, hey, we're going to invite that inner playwright out. And I'm incredibly excited to see what she does, and incredibly proud that OSF, who has worked with deaf actors in the past and is now, and certainly in the Play On program, actor Howie Sego worked on one of Shakespeare's plays in translation. So, you know, this is just a way of expanding the respect that is appropriately earned by that community.
And going alphabetically, the final playwright on the list is Sanaz Tuzi, a child of immigrants, a respected playwright. This is a commission, a co-commission from South Coast Rep, and that is where Cambodian Rock Band originated, is that right?
That is correct.
That is right.
Okay, and so this is a lot of stuff that she brings to the table too.
Yeah, and she wrote a play that we first found out about her called English, and it's, you know, when you talk about the American story, you're also talking about a story of language. And who knows what she will write for her commission. She can write whatever she wants, but that play captured the experiences of people struggling with that, finding that way into that part of being an American or being an American resident, is the power of English and the power of language and how it impacts you and how you feel about yourself speaking that language and not speaking that language. And it's deep and beautiful and funny. And so, again, it was another good day at work when you're hanging out with Sanaz.
No doubt. So how big or small a community is professional theater? I mean, it seems like there's like 2 degrees of separation where there's
I
six
would say
of
it's one degree one, of separation.
Really?
Yeah, it is. It is a multi-billion-dollar industry that impacts communities across the United States and our territories. I mean, it is everywhere you look. My relationships are nationwide, you know, and across the pond.
So given that background then, for just the two of you sitting here, and granted, you probably weren't the only people picking the playwrights, but so how do you narrow the list to just six for this next round?
Oh, my friend. It's very hard, and it's this is reductive because it's turning humans into food, but you know, there is a, much like in season selection, you're creating a buffet, right? You don't want the same thing over and over again. So you look at style and you look at voice and you look at knowledge that people bring both from lived experience or their particular passions, and you create something that feels like it is in itself a work of art. This group of people together, and you count yourself lucky that people are even willing to take part in this project.
And yet a little bit of faith to it. You don't necessarily know what's coming, and so there's something really exciting about launching the possibility of these voices into the world just to see what might happen.
Yeah.
Stepping into the beyond for them and for you.
Yeah.
Totally.
Wanted to point out too that one of the things that's impressive about this list, let me go through again, the six people recently named: Zakiya Alexander, Jacqueline Backhouse, E.M. Lewis, Mary Catherine Nagel, Sarah Novich, and Sanas Tusi. Several of these people not only write plays, but teach other people to write plays, I notice.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the point is, I was a teacher. I taught at CalArts for a number of years. I think the beauty of being an artist is that part of what you're doing is learning what you're doing, and part of what you're doing is passing it on to somebody else. So I think that actually makes sense that most of these people have taught or are teaching at some point.
Yep.
I'm still struck by the fact that there's really no direction other than making sure you pick good people up front. There's no like, okay, do a play about, well, Millard Fillmore was the example we gave. There's nothing like that.
Probably not the best example, but I think it goes back to the, we don't want to fool ourselves into thinking that there is one American history that I sitting in my office can tell you what it is. So let's have the, what American history is, be curated together by 37 artists or groups of artists. And that is, I think, a more open-hearted look at history.
And even that is a tiny little group of voices. If you think about all of the experiences in the world, we're just actually culling out a little piece in these 37 voices. And these 37 voices will be extremely impactful, but that's not all. That's not all there is to tell about the impact of American history.
That's such a difference, though, isn't it? I mean, generally in the artistic world, in the commercial artistic world, where you're trying to make money at this too, but where instead of saying, okay, here's what we want to do, we want to make sure we structure it like this. Do it, notice my white man voice here, but okay. You know, let's get this all structured a certain way and make sure we, you know, hit these bases. But you're just saying, go.
But even
be who you are.
Even Broadway is an experiment. Even you know, like I have friends who've worked on Broadway shows, got all the way through previews, and they shut down before opening night because of the commercial part of that. But the other part of it is still artistic. It's still about an experiment to see if something can be brought to light in this way or that way. And so this act that we're doing is actually really normal in the field. You provide an opportunity for people to use their voice, and then you look for an opportunity to put that voice into the world, and then you look for another opportunity to further push that voice further into the world, and maybe it makes it to Broadway, and maybe it just makes it to a reading, and maybe that was that writer's way of writing towards something else. If you look at how Shakespeare wrote, I know that there are a couple of plays in Shakespeare's canon that if he knew we were still doing them, I think he would have a problem with it. And so I think we just have to think about the work of the artist in that way. That is something that is age old. That's writers that wrote in the 16th century. That's writers that write now. That's, you know, in the 8th century. Like that's how it's done. That's what the artistic process is about.
Which makes sense then that you get works of art that are discovered by later generations, because in their own time they were like, what is this?
Exactly.
They had no commercial possibilities then.
Exactly.
But then 150. Well, Moby Dick. I was just reading about this recently. Herman Melville had no money when he died.
Yep. That is the life of the artist. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. let's hope for better successes for the people you've hired to do the next six. So far we're good. So let's talk about the American Revolution's plays that are on stage at Shakespeare this year and elsewhere for that matter, because you got what, Great Society is opening on Broadway, did you?
Yeah,
into the
next
room?
Tuesday.
Yes,
woohoo!
We will be there. I'm so excited. I actually have never seen Great Society, and I'm really excited about that second installment of Robert Schenken's amazing work.
So it's the second of the two LBJ plays.
I believe
plays.
It is the second, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. Yeah. So Follows All the Way, which of course won a Tony Award on Broadway.
Yep.
The famous scene where Robert Schenken got to the microphone and said, Bill Rausch, Bill Rausch, Bill Rausch.
Oh, that's so sweet that you remember.
I saw it just a few months ago at the Bill Rausch retrospective. So. But yeah, I kind of let everybody know where the Oregon Shakespeare Festival was. So there's a Great Society opening on Broadway. Indecent has been on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Sweat, we talked about, won a Pulitzer, has been on Broadway. All the Way, obviously, has been on Broadway, won that Tony. And then Indecent is actually on stage at OSF this year right now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. It's I actually saw Indecent on Broadway, and I remember when I first read it, I read it for another theater company that I'm a company member of still, and I just thought, wow, who's going to do this? You know, like how do you do this play? And then, of course, you know, that the rest is history. Paula Vogel and Lynn Nottage, which I think is really quite remarkable that both of those playwrights in the same year were up for Tony Awards. And those plays were written out of a commission through the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. That, I think that's really important to make sure that that's highlighted, because that is how impactful this work is. We don't do it to bring it to Broadway. We do it because we want to make sure that these voices are heard, and that history is becomes more complex, and our understanding of history is more complex. But the impact can also go as far as Broadway or the West End.
So to talk about the story of Indecent. This is a love story celebrating Yiddish language and literature. And it's about the play God of Vengeance, and artists who faced persecution bring it to Broadway in 1923.
Yeah. So I also want to call out that this was a co-production with the Yale Repertory Theater, co-commissioned with Yale Repertory Theater, and then Yale and La Jolla produced it first. Another great example of why we want plays to have partners, because mm-hmm. they could bring it out when we were not ready to put in our season for various logistical reasons. Indecent is a beautiful, beautiful love story against the backdrop of a play written by Sholem Ash, that was done around Europe to great acclaim. It came to the United States, played in Yiddish and the Lower East Side in Manhattan. Great acclaim, and then it moved to Broadway where it had a different fate. But throughout the play is the core story of love, first and foremost, and of, again, how language moves us through history and the barriers it break down and the barriers it creates. And it's written, the actors in the play perform many, many roles. So you get the sense of the acting troupe, you know, traveling through Europe, doing this play wherever they could. And it's lovely, lovely work.
And how it, I think one of the things that was truly impactful for me when I watched it was how afraid we are of witnessing love and witnessing tenderness, how much more primed we are towards violence, so much so that when we experience love, we often react violently, and how scary it is because it when you witness love, real love, like the fabric of real love, it exposes something in you, and I think people become really afraid of it. And the impact
has
of,
a way of doing that, doesn't it?
And that's what I mean. That's sort of the beauty of you know, that's the beauty of the theater, is that you have to sit in a room with other people and have your vulnerabilities exposed while you're sitting next to strangers. You know, and that act is a revolutionary act all by itself.
Let's talk about the other American Revolutions play that's on stage at the Shakespeare Festival now, Between Two Knees. And I noticed that it's always surrounded with the phrase, it's okay to laugh.
Yes, it is. So this is another co-commission with New Native Theater in Minneapolis. And it was created by a group called the 1491s, which is a Native comedy troupe. They do great videos. And they had never written a play before. But artistic director Rihanna Yazzie from New Native Theater brought them to us, and we decided to sort of jump in together. And it's extremely, extremely funny, and it's written very much for Native people, and it is not written with making our white audiences feel that the play was written for them. But it's also at the same time, I'll just, you know, at the top, it very much there's a, not a narrator, a narrator character, but he's not really a narrator. He does a lot of other stuff. And he says, it's okay to laugh. We know that you're in the audience and we know what you paid for these tickets and, you know, you laugh and be uncomfortable if you want, but when you leave, you'll still own everything. So it's gentle and honest, and it's a, you know, I don't think, certainly American theaters and I think American entertainment in general does not generally put forth the Native view without trying to filter it through the white preference and the white gaze. And this is completely not that. And that is why, one, it's selling out, so get your tickets fast. but also I think it's super refreshing because audiences actually, in my experience, audiences really respect the honesty of the conversation and take it seriously when they say it's okay to laugh, and then find yourself laughing at the crimes perhaps that your ancestors committed in a way that helps you own that and realize that the legacy of Native American genocide is still something that I as a white person am profiting from, and I can hold it as a truth rather than something for me to run away from.
Wow, that is profound. Let us talk about the history plays for next year, Confederates and the Copper Children. But first, let's talk about it being a Jubilee year.
So the Jubilee is a focus on, I'd like to say that a focus on seldom heard voices across the theater sphere. Theaters nationwide are participating in this Jubilee that focuses on voices by women, people of color, LGBTQIA people with disabilities, all of the marginalized voices within our society. And however you represent, however you see yourself within those, that representative lens. OSF was one of the very first theaters to join the Jubilee. As an individual artist before I received this position, I was also joining the Jubilee. I think basically what it does, the point was by 2020 there will be by 2050 there'll be no majority race in the United States. And 2020 was sort of the beginning of how things were going to shift. And so 2020 was the year where we wanted to look at what it would be like in a time where these were the majority voices that were heard and seen and felt and impacting our stages. And so making a pledge to make sure that these voices are preferenced in your season planning, that these are the voices that you actually are interested in engaging. These are the artists. This is what they're going to look like. These are the people who are going to be working on these are the artists that are going to be working behind the stage. These are all the creatives. And part of the point of that is to say, actually, there's no such thing as the status quo. We're just going to erase that status quo and create this new thing, which is like a pot that's filled with everybody.
Wow, that's a big project for theater companies all over the country.
Yeah, actually it's not, because if you think about it, in the last 10 years, theater companies have been engaging in these ways. Post-multiculturalism has brought this rise to locating playwrights and actors and designers and directors who come from all kinds of backgrounds to come together and tell the stories of our stages. And so I feel like it's a culmination of a century's worth of work, if you ask me.
Can you give us capsule descriptions of Confederates and the Copper Children in next year's season in a minute?
Sure. Do you want to talk about Confederates? Because Nataki's directing it.
Directing Confederates by Dominique Morisseau. And it looks at an African-American woman in the middle of the Civil War who, by all accounts, is trying to become a spy for the Union Army. And another African-American woman in modern times, in the 20-teens, who is a college professor in one of those schools that was built in, 1819 or something like that. And then there are three central characters that sort of move between those two worlds. And it looks at the question that was posed by Ta-Nehisi Coates, why Black people don't celebrate the Civil War. Study the Civil War. And it's really important to me. It's really near and dear to me because it's a question I actually never thought of, but it's very true. We don't. As an African-American woman, it's not something that I look at as a deep part of my history. And part of that is because it's been codified by the white lens of the story between the warring brothers. And so this play actually looks at a different side of it.
You got about 15 seconds for Copper Children.
Copper Children, Irish orphans on the streets of New York. What do we do with them? Let's send them out to Arizona. And then the play tells you what happens.
Yes.
Okay, so more great stuff from the American History Project called American Revolutions, the United States History Cycle at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Confederates and the Copper Children next year, Between Two Knees and Indecent on stage at the festival now. New season coming up starting next February, or is it March?
It starts next February.
Okay. We are Nataki Garrett, the artistic director of the festival. Thank you so much for being here. Allison Carey, the American Revolutions director. Always good to see you.